Hi, this is Dark Journalist. Tonight I have a special episode for you. We're going to be joined by former Assistant HUD Secretary Catherine Austin Fitz. Now, this will be one of the most important episodes that Catherine has ever done, as she goes on record exposing the master plan being rolled out by powerful covert elements in government, industry, and the media. These forces intend to put in place a massive global control grid engineered from an ominous space infrastructure, using tools like entrainment, mind control, social engineering, and social manipulation to achieve total dominance over the population. Catherine introduces us to the idea of AI superpowers being in a deep power struggle for supremacy over the Internet of Things, using a kind of Skynet. Can we regain the initiative from a lawless, marauding group of elites who have no regard for humanity's future? Here we go. Former Assistant HUD Secretary Catherine Austin Fitz, Space Wars, AI Superpowers, and the Black Budget. Catherine, it's great to see you.
It's great to be back, Daniel.
You know, it's amazing. I've been reading your recent report, which is the Will ESG Turn the Red Button Green? This is fantastic. And of course, all the reports are quite amazing. But I found you were doing something with this red button, green button imagery that you've brought forward so many times. And it goes back to this idea of, is the actual, the citizenry involved, are they willing to take the chances and make the moves on this? What is ESG? Let's start there.
ESG stands for Environmental Social Responsibility and Governance. Mm-hmm. And it's a collection of criteria by which you analyze a company, a stock, or a financial situation. And traditionally, when you make an investment, again, company or stock, the question is, what is the financial performance going to be? And the idea of ESG is to also underwrite the stock for their environmental impact, their social impact, and the quality of their governance, on the theory that those risk issues and those opportunities will have a long-term impact on their performance. So it's the underwriting of a company or a stock for non-financial performance. So ESG is used to screen investments.
And would you say it's kind of like an ethical radar? Is this company doing something ethical with the investment we're giving it?
Well, it was first proposed as an ethical. Now it's just being used for central control. Okay. So it's a capital control technique. If you look at the people who've engineered central control using the federal credit, you know, they need a new act other than stealing from the federal government. And so once you've created a series of monopolies, you're going to use holier than thou to consolidate your position. Mm-hmm. That's the way I see it. Now, what I will tell you is ESG properly used could rock the world and pull the rug out from under them. So it's being weaponized. You know, a potentially very powerful system is being weaponized to consolidate the monopolies and to implement things like climate change. Mm-hmm. We can talk about that. Part of that, in my opinion, is just to help engineer the train tracks. They need to do digital currencies. It's a more complicated topic. But ESG suddenly became exceptionally fashionable starting late last year. It's been going on for centuries, but suddenly you saw a big kick up in in promoting it. And it was really, you know, the best defense is a good offense.
Right.
So suddenly you saw all the guys who stole the $50 trillion during the financial coup suddenly announcing, you know, that they're going to be holier than thou. They're going to use ESG and we ought to too. And if you dig down and look at what they're up to, it's going to give them more control. Oh. So, you know, their idea is social responsibility, environmental responsibility, and good governance is more control for us.
How does this Global Investment Sustainable Alliance come into the picture?
They're a group that's tracking what's going on in different continents and trying to keep track of how much money is managed using ESG criteria. Mm-hmm. So they're really a loose association of people who are tracking, you know, what's happening in the investment world. I think of them as a data provider.
So let's think of this maybe as, you know, I've seen these ads with Lloyd Blankfein saving the environment, for example, and Jeff Bezos saying, I'm giving $10 billion for climate change. And so this is the kind of thing that they're going to roll out where these billionaires are getting in front of this as the face of it and saying, we're going to save this planet and don't you worry about a thing.
Right. As you know, in October 2018, the government adopted FASB 56, FASB Statement 56, which allowed it to basically take its finances, or they took the premise, or they adopted an administrative policy that basically said they didn't have to obey the Constitution or the financial management laws. They could simply keep secret books.
Right.
Okay, now, the practical implications, which I described in the prior research, and you can find it at HUDmissingmoney.salary.com. What that did, Daniel, is that took the entire U.S. security, or at least 80% of the U.S. securities market dark. So now most pension funds, most IRAs, most retirement are investing in treasury securities, which are bonds issued by an entity, which is keeping secret books. And for all you know, all the money's leaving out the back door. We already know there's $21 trillion. So this is basically saying we're going to take traditional financial disclosure required for securities and throw it out the window.
Right.
Okay. When the SEC was invited to make comment on this proposal before it was adopted, they said no comment.
Wow.
Now the SEC is in charge of making sure people obey the financial disclosure laws. So for the SEC to say no comment is quite remarkable. So you're basically tearing up 200 years of best practices on managing the country's wealth, you know, whether it's your wealth, my wealth, or the, you know, what's being managed for the pension funds or what's in our Social Security Trust Fund, because now you're talking about emptying out the collateral behind the Social Security Trust Fund.
Right.
So while all of this is going on, ESG is being used as whiteout. It's a weapon. So you are engaging people in a conversation, which is a complete distraction from the meat. It's kind of like saying, oh, no, we don't need meat. We need more dessert.
Right.
You know, we need more Kool-Aid.
Right.
From a financial standpoint, this is the equivalent of driving a car off the cliff. It's unbelievable. Anyway, so one of the things ESG is currently being used for is whiteout.
Mm-hmm.
Now, another thing I think it's being used at, if you study who is doing de-dollarization, so do you know what I mean when I say de-dollarization?
Yes.
Okay. If you look at who is doing de-dollarization, it's basically the oil producers plus China.
Mm-hmm.
You know, and it's a symbiosis because China needs the oil and they need the revenues. They're the ones who are de-dollarizing. And if you look at what it's going to take for the G7 nations and the dollar zone to convert to a cryptocurrency, they have to come off the petrodollar and they have to stop feeding revenues to the guys who are de-dollarizing. So divide the world into a dollar zone and then a group of oil producers who are de-dollarizing along with China. This group, if you look at this group, To keep the dollar going and to keep it going as a cryptocurrency, they need an alternative to the energy model and to the asset control model. Mm-hmm. So they need to come off the petrodollar. What do they need to do? They need to electrify. So if you look at the climate change op is designed to basically force electrification at high speed and allow that group to lock in the global currency. You know, it's the pushback of the unipolar model.
So who is pushing, well, let's say, do you think that they're pushing then cryptos as that universal currency?
Well, they're pushing digital. So, you know, I said, it's funny, the quote that's at the top of this is the one I had in 2008. I said, Mr. Global doesn't care if the digital global, you know, if the global currency is called dollars, gold, wampum beads, all Mr. Global cares about is this digital. You know, so Mr. Global, you know, it could be MasterCard. It doesn't have to be cryptocurrencies.
Okay.
What Mr. Global wants is low cost, low fee, low transactions, but on a digital infrastructure where you can also do energy and you can bring out breakthrough energy as soon as you have a sufficient digital infrastructure, and you can do mind control. Because remember, one of the things you've always used the financial system for was control. Now that you have entrainment and mind control and all sorts of, you know, whiz-bang technologies, currency changes its function or the manner in which it functions as a control system.
Mm-hmm.
Okay. So currencies have different functions, but the nature of money as a control system changes and morphs with changes in technology. So you need, what you need to do to maintain that currency global position is you need electrification, mm-hmm. or you need the digital train tracks, you know, from space and the suborbital platform to the cables under the ocean, you know, into the last mile of the Internet things, into the smart meter, into the phone, you know, and I hate to say it with nanotechnology, into the brain machine interface.
Right.
So right now they are on a tear to, you know, think of this like a gold rush. It's the Internet of Things gold rush. And they, you know, the winner is the guy who controls the hardware, the digital train tracks. And that's what they're building out in high speed. And if they can electrify transportation and also deliver solar energy from the suborbital platform and different technologies like that, you know, they can cut all the oil guys loose.
Wow. Wow. And then you'll see a real throwdown.
Well, that's the war right now. Can the oil producers plus China de-dollarize, you know, fast enough to create a multipolar world? I mean, think of it this way. Mr. Global is on both sides. Mr. Global doesn't care who wins. Mr. Global cares we have a digital currency.
Mm-hmm.
So you see a competition between different factions for the control of the digital currencies. One of my questions before the coronavirus is, are we going to split into two digital systems? Is the solution going to be, you know, you have a China-based Asian digital system and then you have a U.S. dollar-based?
Right, right.
So, yeah, so this is going to come down to building out the digital infrastructure for the digital currency. And again, you know, there's no currency on the planet right now that could compete with the dollar. That's the problem. The dollar is dangerous and dominant, but there is enough GNP growing fast that wants to get away from the dollar that we're coming into what is a very difficult period. Now, it's interesting. You know, at the end of the year, if you talk to investment advisors all around the world and money managers,
mm-hmm.
you know, they were saying, okay, time to leave the dollar and move to other currencies. Time to get out of the U.S. stock market, move into the currencies that are growing. And voila, end of December, it's a miracle. You know, we had another miracle, just like the last 10 miracles, you know, where suddenly something happens and whoop, dollar comes back.
Yeah.
U.S. stock market comes back. It's another amazing coincidence.
Well, I have, you know, it's fascinating. I have about three questions based on what you were just talking about. Well, when we started the year, we had this very unusual incident where, out of nowhere, it seemed like, the Trump administration assassinated basically the number two man in Iran, risking World War III and all these other things. That seemed to me to be oriented directly at the oil model that you're talking about. What do you think was going on there?
So I don't I don't begin to have the intelligence, you know, that we need to understand what was going on. Here's the question. Who is it that Netanyahu fronts for? Yeah. Let me say it this way. But I think, you know, that's the group that's backing Trump. And they are very aggressive thinking, you know, they have Trump at least until January 20th of next year. And, you know, they've got whatever they have to do to start a war with Iran, or basically to beat Iran into sanction submission, you know, they've got until right. then. They don't know who's going to run things after that. So I see that group as making, you know, to me, it's more an organized crime syndicate. They're making a play to make sure they control that turf.
Right.
You know, if you look at the message to the de-dollarization, if I understand what Mike Pompeo said after the assassination, he basically said, we reserve the right to assassinate any leader, anytime, anywhere in the world who's acting against our best interest.
Right.
Now, if that is in fact our policy, you know, that was a very chilling message.
Big time. Yeah, right. Absolutely. Well, it's fascinating because there are a number of things coming out of the Trump administration that are like that now that, say, weren't there in the first couple of years. And one of the things that, you know, we pointed out is the this whole thing around you not criticizing Israel so that they institute this new policy. And you've done a lot of coverage on that. What is it that's happening to this administration? And, you know, which is to say nothing of their competition, but just with them, there's something going on with the Trump administration, which wasn't there before. And it seems like it is this kind of lawless approach and that they're going to institute things.
Here's my guess. And I'll go way back. You know, I did this Salieri report on last year on the Forrestal assassination. And if you go back and you look at the Forrestal assassination, the McCarthy assassination, the Kennedy assassination, and that whole series, what it looked like to me, Daniel, is at that time to create the national security state, you had the fusion of two syndicates. One was the, I'll call them their Ergun organized crime syndicate, with the sort of Dulles Rockefeller organized crime syndicate. And between the two of them, they had incredible presence. And clearly the Rockefeller faction had incredible presence on the overt side. But on the organized crime side, you're talking about, particularly if you network them into London, you know, they basically control transnational global organized crime. And, you know, it really looked like there was a breakout in a fight between the two groups coming into the 2016 election.
Yeah.
And here's the interesting thing. You know, I go back to the first Bush administration. The Bushes were very careful and put a lot of stress on, okay, here's the overt world, here's the covert world. You know, we do this kind of here, but we don't do that upstairs. You know, we keep the two worlds separate. The Clintons had grown up in a very small state and were younger, and they're like, oh, that's too hard.
Right.
You know, why, you know, let's just get the work done. And so they were much more frontal, you know, and literally, I'll never forget the period when people in this is as the Clinton death list counted up and up, people were dropping like flies.
Yeah.
And you were like, you know, are we in the middle of a mob war? What's going on?
All right.
So I think what has happened as the two factions are fighting, you have such profound secrecy, and it's gotten much worse, that there's a real deterioration in trying to keep the pretense going that, you know, we operate under the rule of law. I mean, we've literally seen in the last month a state of ridiculousness in and around the Department of Justice that can only be described. I mean, I feel like I'm watching something put on by a joint venture of The Onion and Saturday Night Live. You can't, you can't fathom that this is really, and it's just like my poster of Mike Bloomberg. Mm-hmm. You know, I always say people who win in a rigged game get stupid, but what you're watching is people who've forgotten what the facts are. You know, they're literally operating without proper financial disclosure and feedback loops. And it's almost like if you can get away with murder using mind control, that you end up mind controlled. You forget.
So their own entrainment has created this kind of Frankenstein monster.
I don't know. I can't understand it. I know that there's a logical reason. You know, but when you watch someone like Mike Bloomberg say, oh, well, there's not enough money for Social Security and Medicare. It's, really, Mike? There's $21 trillion missing from the federal government. Right. There's $29 trillion that went out on bailouts. Now, you made your fortune providing data to Wall Street. You mean you didn't see that $50 trillion go by?
Right.
Where is it, Mike?
Yeah.
You know, because we know a portion of it is in your bank account.
Right.
I mean, come on. You know, or if you listen to him talk about the fact that, you know, there's more crime in minority neighborhoods. Well, what about Two Wall Street? Mm-hmm. I mean, look at the laws broken and the legal settlements by J.P. Morgan. So I had a subscriber who was still banking at J.P. Morgan Chase. And I said to her, you know, I would be afraid to have money at J.P. Morgan Chase, even $10. You know, why take that risk? Yeah. Anyway, so she had some time on her hands, and I had her put together a list of every settlement that they had made for unethical or illegal behavior since 2002. The list was so long, it took us weeks to proof it. I had our editor proof it.
Wow.
And it was a huge job because they have broken so many laws. It's beyond a belief. And when we finished, we made this huge table press so the subscribers can go in and manipulate it and look at it in different ways. I was, obviously, I wrote up the case history of J.P. Morgan Chase in the ESG presentation.
Right.
But I was at a loss of words to say anything. You know, you're talking about a major criminal operation. This is major intentional crime year after year after year. And kick back to the Department of Justice. They're in business together. Mm-hmm. You know, it's basically a racketeering operation. You know, they make money and then they kick back commissions to the Department of Justice and on we go. So at the end, that's why we put a picture of an owl with a definition of flabbergasted. The owl's looking like. Because, what do you say?
Yeah.
I mean, yeah. It was, I used to have an uncle who was a, taught at West Point, he used to say, it's stupefying. It's so stupefying. But the fact that anybody would bank at a company that would engage in that criminality, to me, that is what is most stupefying. And apparently, you know, I'm told 50% or more directly or indirectly in America bank at J.P. Morgan Chase.
Amazing.
So, you know, here I come back to the red button problem. We are financing what's killing us.
Mm-hmm.
So we are, you know, whether it's degradation of the food supply, whether it's the OxyContin epidemic or OxyContin, Purdue was a private company. But, you know, if you look at the companies and the government agencies doing this, we are financing them. Mm-hmm. And if you finance the people killing you, you're going to die. That's how it works. There's no way out.
Mm-hmm.
It's funny. Have you seen Yellowstone yet?
Yes.
Have you seen the second season?
I'm getting in there.
Okay. So I don't want to give away the plot, but the question, Yellowstone was the movie of the year last year on the Salary Report.
Yes.
And that's because the dirtiest players in the Valley are two guys named Beck Brothers.
Right.
And the Beck Brothers have been getting away with it for 50 years because they're dirty and everybody's afraid of them. But at some point you have to sit back and say, okay, what are we going to do about the Beck brothers?
Right.
And if you look at the two factions that right now are fighting for control, you know, and are playing the game in the election, both factions are unacceptable.
Yeah.
You know, you can't run a country where both sides of the aisle are essentially controlled by dual citizen passports, you know, and people who are afraid of saying no.
Yeah.
So the U.S. government doesn't have information sovereignty, it doesn't have financial sovereignty.
It is. It's a dire state of affairs in terms of that kind of transparency. I want to jump to that missing trillions, though, and get this down. Like, the update on this, how do you feel about the response of the media? Because the media has picked up on it at times. They've had almost, as soon as you brought it out, especially after you did the work with Professor Mark Skidmore, and it became something that both of you did, suddenly the media was like, oh, we have to kind of address it now, even though you've been working on this for two decades. So they sort of addressed it in Forbes and in other things with questions like, is there $21 trillion missing, you know, from the budget? And how do you feel when you see that out there? Do you think that they are sort of, they have their plan for how to kind of kick the ball on that and get it out of the public's mind?
Well, I think you saw several different things going on. I think you saw legitimate reporters trying to cover it, but not able to, you know, when the U.S. government says, oh, well, it's not real. The question is, how do you blow by that? Because the only way you can show that something is not real is if you have a properly managed and operated financial operation, and you've got audits, and it's credible. So if you're breaking all the laws and not complying with any of the laws for financial disclosure, and you say, oh, well, it's not real, on what basis? In other words, you're talking about something which is completely and utterly out of control and has no credibility. But if you're going to give it credibility, then, you know, I don't know how to explain it. It's kind of a, you're talking about a Patty Hearst syndrome.
Yeah.
Right. So you basically have a group of people saying, we can run the federal government, we can do whatever we want, and we don't have to tell you anything we're doing, and you have to keep paying us taxes, and if you don't, we'll kill you.
Yeah.
So if you're a reporter, what do you say to that, which is going to sell newspapers and be interesting?
Mm-hmm.
You know, it's kind of a dead end.
Yeah.
And there's nothing really more to say on the subject. So then you had a couple of other efforts that were efforts to just distract or white it out or kill the story.
Yes.
So most of it I saw is, you know, let's kill it. Let's turn it to entertainment was one, you know, and then real legitimate people trying to do things.
Yeah.
And I think the question is, you have many, many citizens sitting down and figuring out, okay, now how? And so I see, I see the conversation has really changed to how do we assert a common law right of offset, or how do we find how the money works in our neighborhood, or how do we, how do we leave Virginia and join West Virginia as a county, or how do we create a Second Amendment sanctuary, you know, in this county, or how do we get a new sheriff elected? So to me, the conversation has changed to how, and it is through that discussion of how that the common law right of offset, the money's going to come up, because you've got to have a way to claw the money back, whether you claw it back through the banks or you claw it back through the government. But that's how it's got to happen.
So there has to be a mechanism. It's interesting that you've mentioned this thing about the states, where you see these kind of, you know, what you might call red state portions of particular states trying to join up with other red state portions of those states. So you have situations like parts of Oregon trying to join parts of Idaho and so on. What do you think of that? I mean, is this what the kind of groundswell of looking for a way out?
Well, the only change that can come is got to come bottom up. And ultimately, a lot of that's got to be county by county. So if you look at the cash flows of how the country operates in terms of cash flows, it comes bottom up. And the problem with the swamp is from sea to shining sea. Mm-hmm. So if you look at how this whole game plays out at a local level, you've got a group of people making money on things which are destroying the community, and a group of people who like to make money on things that build up the community. And ultimately, you have to switch the cash flows. There's no other way out. Now, what has been happening is the central bank's been printing money and using that money, whether directly or through the federal government, to buy everybody up and pay them off. But mm-hmm. at some point, you know, either they won't have the capability of doing that without massive inflation, or people are going to reach the point where, you know, they're not prepared to be bought at the cost of, you know, what's going to happen next. So it all has to come down to how you're going to switch the money.
Absolutely. I was thinking about your work on the black budget and how it, you know, goes into a neighborhood, destroys it, and moves on to the next one, and really creates these kind of ghost towns. And right. in New England here, in New Hampshire and Vermont, and places that weren't really so drug-riddled, you know, have these big drug problems in Maine now. And it's interesting to read about it because, you know, it's this sweep. It's almost like they've decided, well, we need to kind of grow the percentage. Where can we go next? And then it just floods into that neighborhood right. and into these places. And even places where it seems very unusual. You know, we have these horrible videos of people ODing in cars and things like that. But that's the way that they operate.
Right. It's amazing. I don't know. Have you seen The Pharmacist yet?
Yes.
I just, the Salary Report this week, The Pharmacist is Let's Go to the Movies selection. Yeah. And if you look at the commentary, I describe my impressions of watching The Pharmacist. And what's interesting is the budget deal in 1995 busted in November 1995. And that's the story. Remember my story of the top pension fund investors saying they've given up on the country. They're moving all the money out.
Yes.
The give up was supposedly around the 95. The inability to craft a responsible budget plan for both the federal budget and the retirement, Social Security, pension, everything. You know, so let's say that's correct, that information is correct. They gave up in November 95. When did the FDA approve OxyContin? December 1995. Because I told you, if you can't fashion a financial solution, the only way you can balance the budget is by lowering life expectancy.
And this is the story where this is the head of CalPERS who was telling you this at the time.
Right.
And the gist of it was he's saying they've already given up on the country and you were thinking, oh, they're going to ship the money overseas. Basically, they're going to.
What I thought he meant was we're going to reallocate the pension investments to invest more money in the high growth areas. Mm-hmm. And what I didn't understand he meant was, no, we're going to have a financial coup d'etat. We're going to bubble the U.S. economy and suck $50 trillion out and move it wherever. Mm-hmm. I didn't understand. And to deal with the ultimate retirement problem, we'll lower life expectancies and, you know, get more control and institute technocracy, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. So if you at the end of The Pharmacist is the deposition video with Richard Sackler, which I also put up in the commentary. So if you go to Solari, it's the John Rappaport interview, and it's got the trailer from The Pharmacist in my description, and then just the 2.5-minute deposition of Richard Sackler. There is a man, and the question I asked was, I want to know, in December 1995, who sat down with Richard Sackler and agreed that he could go kill a million people using OxyContin? Because they knew. That was, if you look at how they rolled out the pill mills with protection from enforcement and top-down protection, that was a plan. Because if you look at those neighborhoods, You know, if I still had the Community Wizard software tool, what I could show you in Louisiana where Dan Schneider was operating as a pharmacist, you know, at the same time they're hitting that neighborhood with OxyContin, they're hitting it with meth, and they're hitting it with predatory student loans, and they're hitting it with predatory mortgages and predatory auto loans. And it's all hitting like a tsunami. Mm-hmm. You know, the African-Americans used to call it the beatdown.
Right.
But that was a concerted effort. And it's very interesting. In 1996, I was at a conference. I think it was Esther Dyson's conference with, and Bloomberg was up on the stage with a group of venture capitalists. And I said to him, because my company had Bloomberg's, you know, we were a client of Bloomberg. And I said to him, why don't you put government data on so that we can do this arbitrage between government, you know, places and the stock market. And I explained the data model of Community Wizard, and he turned white as a sheet. And I realized, oh, they're making all their money arbitraging that data. They have to keep it secret.
Right.
You know, that's the big ace in the hole, is playing that card. So he knew in 1996.
Amazing.
Well, he's part of that whole group. I mean, if you look at Sackler and Jamie Dimon and all mm-hmm. those folks in New York, you know, and it's unbelievable because he's sitting there saying that the crime is in the minority neighborhoods.
Right.
I mean, I don't know how many people get killed in minority neighborhoods in New York every year, but Sackler's killed, I'm sure, many more.
Absolutely. Absolutely. And you've jumped into two different discussions there. One is the 2020 election and the other is vaccines.
Well, but here's the thing. I look at everything. Remember, I built a digital infrastructure that would allow me to look at, you know, places and industries. So, for example, we had one software tool where you could put in the tickers for your 1,000 largest Fortune 500 companies, and it would print out where your employees were globally. So it would print a map and show you where your where the people who essentially work for you were. If you talk with most people about what's going on in their community, they have a picture of what's going on. And then if you look at how the money works, you know, it's a totally different picture. And if you try and get them out of the trance, and this is one of the reasons the reporters who were looking at the $21 trillion, you know, what they were fighting was the trance of the individual who doesn't want to sit down and look at how the money really works in their community or around them and take responsibility. I can't tell you the emotional resistance to doing that. It's extraordinary. And yet it's unbelievable. You know, if you go on this journey of understanding how the money works in your county and in your place, you know, it's what the Buddha says, those who are awake live in a state of constant amazement.
Yeah.
And, you know, you really see how the world works. But you see a lot about the covert side. And, of course, I think a lot of people want to avoid looking at the covert side because they don't want to upset the powers that be.
Well, it's interesting coming out of that trance because you need some sort of incentive, right? So what's the incentive to come out of the trance?
Well, the only reason I came out, I mean, I built Community Wizard because I saw an incredible opportunity with digital technology and new technology. You know, if you look at the current wealth in the country, we could be 100 times more wealthy. Mm-hmm. So I just saw that the wealth potential was fantastic. And the more I dug into research, the more wealth potential I discovered. Now, the problem with that opportunity is if you're in control, if you realize that wealth potential, there's no guarantee you're going to keep control and you're probably going to lose control. You know, so if you want to keep control and use that technology to control, you're going to shrink the economy, but you'll stay in control. And that's part of the war we're seeing. Because if you look at the faction that wanted to stay global versus the faction that wants to nationalize, mm-hmm. that's really a war about, okay, how are we going to optimize economically? And one is saying you have to have bottom-up optimization, particularly now that we take the internet the last mile and integrate it in with the real estate. And they're saying, okay, you got to optimize. And at some point, this level of crime is going to kill the goose that laid the golden egg, which is true. Mm-hmm. But nobody seems, you know, secrecy and organized crime profits are an addiction. And the people who have that addiction are not inclined to give it up.
Right. Right, absolutely. One of the puzzles in all this that has always struck me as a missing piece is things like global spraying or vaccines or whatever, or 5G, for example. Those same, let's just say, elites who are controlling this board game, they and their families are subject to things like 5G or global spraying pollution. How do they get around that?
It's a very good question. You know, for years I couldn't understand the global spraying because I thought, well, now in my experience, the top guys often will roll out something and have the anecdote to it. Mm-hmm. So maybe they have technologies that mean it's possible for them to detox faster and better, or, you know, I just don't know. But I think the question comes down to, is this what they think they need to do to control, or is somebody else doing it and they're subject to treaty obligations, they have to go along? Mm-hmm. I mean, that's really the question. Here's the problem with everything we talk about money. Money is just a portion of the governance system.
Right.
And you can't talk about it separate with the governance system. And the problem of integrating it with a conversation about the governance system is the governance system is invisible and it's a mystery. Mm-hmm. I mean, that's to me the most baffling thing about planet Earth is we're all walking around thinking we can live on a planet where the governance system is a mystery and that's okay.
Mm-hmm. Well, you have that famous quote, which is, who is it who's controlling things on planet Earth and why are they acting the way that they're acting? This is interesting because really so much of the work comes back to this question and we don't really have a good answer for it.
No.
No, Fascinating. No,
but I will say this. If you look at global spraying, if you look at how much money I can make, you know, if you just said to me, okay, you're Mr. Global, how much money can you make on weather warfare? You've seen that old video of Lyndon Johnson talking about, you know, he who bragging about the potential for weather warfare and he who controls the weather is going to control the world.
Yeah, so, and that's almost 60 years ago.
Right. So let's presume for a second that they do have weather warfare. If you look at how much money you can make, unbelievable. Mm-hmm. It's got to be the single most profitable weapon in the history of the world.
Mm-hmm. So give us just a regular example. Let's suppose these hurricanes blow through the Bahamas and, you know, all sorts of economic implications happen as a result of that, or disaster capitalism swoops in. So if I've created something like that, or if I create like an earthquake in Haiti, for example, all of these financial opportunities are available to me.
Right.
Well, how about this? How about, what are you telling your subscribers about dealing with the coronavirus?
So the thing I tell my subscribers about dealing with the coronavirus is that we don't know what's the truth and what's not. What we do know is that the quarantine is having profound economic impacts.
Right.
And they could face, you know, we could face anywhere from a supply chain that just that inconveniences them to put them in real danger.
Right.
And so number one is to be prepared for supply chain hiccups and things like pharmaceuticals. You know, if you need antibiotics, this could wipe out the U.S. supply of antibiotics in the short run.
Right.
So you know, I always tell people have 3 months of provision for many reasons, but this is one of them. So I think one is you have to be prepared for supply chain problems, and that includes economic problems. If you're a small business, you know, so I have a small business, you have a small business, we could run into some serious hiccups. Mm-hmm. So that's number two. Number three, there's a real push to use this to implement technocracy and digital cash. So we're coming to the next level of control, and you have to be aware of that. And then finally, I think if they use this to try and keep promoting vaccine mandates, I think the vaccine will be very, very dangerous.
Yes.
So in this situation, number one is to be able to rock and roll with the economic hiccups. But then number two is, you know, we have got to make sure that we don't take that vaccine. That vaccine will be unbelievably dangerous.
Mm-hmm.
I think.
And that might, yeah, that's going to be, if you thought that the religious exemption, New Jersey sort of push against that from the legislators who were pushing it to eliminate the religious exemption, wait till this one comes down.
This one's going to be, this will be like the swine flu. It was very interesting because one of the things John told the story, and you can see it in a little public video about the swine flu, because he and Cheryl Atkinson were working to try and find real cases of swine flu, and they couldn't find any.
Fascinating.
Yeah, no, it was unbelievable. But they were promoting the vaccine like crazy. I think one of the reasons they backed off on the swine flu vaccination, I think one reason was you had a whole world of healthcare providers who started suing and going back because they had the knowledge and intelligence and professionalism to be able to prove, you know, it wasn't an effective vaccine. It wasn't necessary. It was stupid. But the other thing is, I think they just heard a lot of conversations of, you know, there was a real, the pushback was going to be unmanageable.
Yeah.
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 So
the data told them what to do. So that's,
well, they came back around and integrated it with the flu vaccination.
Mm-hmm.
And I had some personal experiences where it did great harm to people I loved.
Oh yeah.
So, yeah. It's very, I wanted to mention one of the things I found interesting when the coronavirus, coverage started is the arrest of Charles Lieber in Boston, Harvard professor.
Yes.
And if you go to, he's a nanotechnology expert, and if you go to Lieber Research, his research group, a lot of their most recent publications are on brain-machine interface with nanotechnology.
Fascinating.
So they're talking about nanotechnology that can move through the cell membrane and create brain-machine interface.
Remarkable. Interesting guy to grab.
Apparently.
And right as this was all happening, I did find that interesting that at the beginning of the year, it was like, here comes Armageddon 2020. You've got coronavirus. You got us killing the number two man in Iran. It just was like this weird frenzy right off the bat. So it told me something about the year and the way that the kind of trend is going.
You, at the end of last year, you had tremendous tension. On one hand, you had the U.S. asserting more sanctions and more control using the dollar system. On the other hand, you had a variety of players, including in G7, basically saying, the U.S. has blown the unipolar model. It's a failure. And now the areas of the world that are growing need a way to trade and transact without this weaponization. In other words, the dollar used to be a liquid instrument. It's being weaponized. We need an alternative.
Uh-huh.
And so you have one group trying to find a way to trade around the dollar. And if you look from 2010 on, all the different ways in terms of alternative to SWIFT payment systems, you know, credit card systems, lending banks as an alternative to IMF. We've had an explosion of what's called de-dollarization and people creating ways of trading. So if you look at the swap capacities that the different central banks have made with each other so they can go around the dollar,
mm-hmm.
all of that, Daniel, is not significant yet in terms of volume. But in terms of creating the train tracks that can handle volume, they're very, very significant.
Interesting.
And, you know, And the last day of December, the dollar, from my point of view, was in real trouble. Mm-hmm. And it's been miraculously resurrected by the situation.
Right. As I said. Brought back. Yeah.
But, and then you had Putin come out at the BRICS meeting and say, essentially, that the dollar was about to collapse and shortly. Now, whether it was Macron and Carney, in fact, wait a minute, I'm losing you there. Carney, so Putin made his comment with the BRICS, and then Macron made his comment after the, or with the French diplomats that the U.S. had blown it. And then Mark Carney said, we need to create an alternative to the dollar because the areas that are growing, they can't use a weapon to trade, and the dollar is being weaponized. Same problem. But then what finally happened was the BIS announced a task force of the Swiss National Bank, the Bank of England, the Canadian Central Bank, and the European Central Bank to do a task force on cryptocurrencies together. Now, that is an earth-shattering development because it excluded the Fed. Now, let me tell you why that's important. If you have $100 billion sitting in treasuries or dollars, and you decide you're going to leave the dollar, where are you going to go? Where are you going to go? You're going to go to yen? You're going to go to euros? You're going to go to gold? In fact, if you look at how much is in the dollar and where it has to go, you're not going to go to the Chinese currency because nobody trusts the Chinese and it's not liquefied sufficiently to mm-hmm. handle the volume. The euro started to be an alternative, but with Brexit and the euro, the European Union doesn't have its own military, you don't quite know where it's going to go. But if you look at the U.S., you say, yes, they have a big military, and yes, they have a liquid dollar, and yes, they have a big central bank, but you know something? They're not under adult supervision. Mm-hmm. So what do? Well, if you put the European Union, the Swiss National Bank, the BIS, and the Brits and Canada together, you've got a nuclear arsenal.
Wow. Which group does Russia fall into?
Russia's the leader of the de-dollarization group.
Right.
They're a huge oil producer, and they have completely shed their dollars in the reserve currency. So if you look at their reserves, they've got it in euro, yen, and gold. They've built enormous swap capacity with China and a variety of other countries, and they've put, for the first time, an office of the Moscow Central Bank in China, which will allow them to swap gold back and forth. So they can swap, currency to currency, but they can also swap gold.
So is that why they're the favorite target of the media, say over the past 3 years?
I don't know, Daniel. It's I have different theories on this, but if you look at what we did since the wall came down, in terms of trying to move missiles, break treaties, and literally surround them. We've been basically after them. When the wall came down, we raped the place. Uh-huh. And I think the group that raped them, and it was a combination of the intelligence agencies and the Treasury, when we raped them, we decided not to completely wipe out the government because we didn't want the nuclear arsenal to fall into the wrong hands. And from what I can tell, we never thought that they would be able to come back as fast as Putin has brought them back. Uh-huh. Now, Russia still has major demographic and other problems. But as they started to come back, there was a real effort to, I don't know whether it's to turn them into the boogeyman or to encircle them. And there are many deep cultural reasons for that war, if you go back through history. And I don't know what the truth is. Mm-hmm. I do think I do think that if you're going to have a unipolar model, and you're going to have a model in which you institute slavery, because really, if you look at what a digital currency is, it's a slavery system, at least the one being designed and worked on now.
Right. It doesn't have to be, but it is.
I think the Russians want to have a human culture. And I think they don't, you know, you have the Orthodox Church, which in many respects is more in integrity. You know, it's the real church in many respects.
Uh-huh.
And so whether it's the Christian, you know, is this an effort to wipe out the Christian thread, or, you know, Steiner would call it the stream.
Mm-hmm.
What is it? But it's almost as though the two value systems can't operate side by side. And unfortunately, if you look at the value system being promoted, you know, sometimes I feel like I woke up and I'm on the wrong side, because what we're seeing, that impulse coming out of the United States, is demonic. It's a cult. And it's very anti-Christian and very anti-life, very anti-freedom.
Uh-huh.
And, you know, and I can never tell if they're simply organized crime or if they're demonic.
Hmm. Well, they're dancing the line there for sure, because so much of the transhumanism finds its roots in things that are happening and coming out of the West. So this
is hard for me to say the West, because I think of the West as high culture.
Uh-huh.
We're talking about an occult culture, which is trying to debase art. It's trying to debase music. It's trying to debase children.
Well, it's interesting how they manipulate these things, too, like in New York with Gender X. This is interesting. You had the most interesting conclusion on this, which I think people really have to zero in on, which is that Gender X and all the things that are coming out of it are not to help some group of transgender people, but in fact, it's about robot rights.
Right. It's well, if you want to integrate robots into the labor system,
uh-huh.
To create a new legal system for robots would be phenomenally time-consuming and expensive. If you could simply modify your current labor system to integrate robots, you save decades and trillions of dollars. And so, I believe what they're doing with the transgender stuff, it's several goals, but one of them is to integrate the robots into the labor system. And to do that, you know, you need to give a birth certificate to labor. You need to, you need to be able to give a birth certificate to a robot.
Mm-hmm.
And you know, obviously you can't give a sex to a robot. So, you know, you create an X.
Right.
So all these things, if you're looking at from the point of view of somebody who wants to keep the taxation system going, it's much more logical than you think. The other thing is, there's no doubt that what you're looking at when you put down the digital train tracks is the Internet of Things. You're looking at a biophysical extraction model. So a human being is no longer a sovereign individual in your economic model. They are a resource, like an oil deposit, to be managed and manipulated like an asset.
Uh-huh.
And you're going to extract not only data, but you're going to influence them to do a variety of things that make you money or help you, you know, whether it's do a school shooting or, you know, buy an SUV online.
Right.
Or, you know, watch pornography or, you know, whatever extraction you're up to. So. What you want to do, and this is the transhumanist part of it, Thomas Meyer calls it subhumanism, which I like much better,
yeah,
is you want to get them to think of themselves as a, you know, as a resource that can be, so a man can become a woman, and you know, it's all part of the debasement, but changing the model. So I don't think of myself as a sovereign individual with divine authority. I think of myself basically as an oil deposit that can be, you know, flipped around.
Right. So I'm an asset to be harvested in a system.
Right. And I can reinvent myself, and all of this can be, you know,
right.
You know, I can be converted into movable parts. I'm a Lego set.
Right.
Right.
Well, Catherine, you've pointed this out, but is it fair to say that this is a very small group that is manipulating these rules and getting tremendous results?
So who's the question? Who is this? You know, one of the challenges, it was Einstein who said that technological progress looks like giving an axe to a psychopath or something like that. I forget the exact quote. Part of this is you have a wide variety of players who are presented with new technology and they feel like, well, you know, if I can, let's do it. And it's raced way ahead of where the regulation or wisdom or sense is. So that's part of it. And the reality is we've had transnational organized crime getting richer and richer and getting away with stuff. I mean, the more they get away with, the more it works for them. And
right.
So, you know, we've gone kind of beyond the pale. So part of this is not necessarily that there's some guy up in the sky planning everything, but you have technology running ahead of our capacity to govern it, is part of what I think. But if you look at the mandate to do vaccines, that's a perfect example of what the world's really going on, because we have an intentional effort to basically reduce a significant portion of the population to a state of chronic disease.
Mm-hmm. Absolutely. I wanted to ask you about this, which was that Professor Peter Dale Scott did a lecture and made some commentary recently, just turned 91.
And a fabulous man.
Incredible yeah. Work. And he does more work than you know, people half his age. It's amazing.
Right.
But he said something. He said, you know, we're talking a lot about division in government, but look at the vote for the NDAA and $750 billion in defense and show me who dissented from that. Republicans, Democrats lined up, passed it. It was out the door. And that really gets to it. When the rubber meets the road, those guys
right.
line up for the subsidies.
Right. Yeah.
Amazing.
Yeah. Remember, Congress has the power of the purse.
Yes.
And we're missing $21 trillion. And I don't notice anybody. You know, I'll never forget, I was working with a fabulous reporter at Insight Magazine. And when there were two criminal cases against DynCorp and then private litigation for engaging in sex slave trafficking in Eastern Europe. One was a UN contract, and I can't remember if the other was UN or AID, but they had, you know, so you have a government contractor who is proven with, in court, irrefutable documentation engaging in sex slave trafficking, including the government technical representative on the contract engaging in sex slave trafficking.
Wow.
So this is, you know, and at the time, the company was the number one contractor at the State Department. So Kelly wrote a fabulous front page, you know, cover article about these lawsuits, the litigation, the proof, the documentation. So here's a government contractor, number one at State Department, running the systems for the HUD-IG, running the Promise software system at the Department of Justice, okay? This is a very wired and connected defense contractors. So we've got the Promise software system. Oh, the SEC enforcement. They're doing SEC enforcement. They're doing HUD, Inspector General. Oh, it turns out war on drugs in South America, they're doing that too. So this is a very plugged-in contractor. Okay, so they're nailed on sex slave trafficking. I took the article, which was shipped to every congressman's office, so they would get a complimentary hard copy, I think, on Fridays. And so every congressional office, every senator, every congressman got Insight Magazine with the cover story of sex slave trafficking by this contractor. And then I took it upon myself to send it to the head of IT contracting and the head of IT at every government agency.
Wow.
In Washington. The next week, or within the next month, the Navy awarded them a huge new contract, and someone else too, might have been State Department, I forget. But two huge new contracts were awarded after that.
Wow.
And no one did a thing. And then they awarded them the contract running the post office sorting facility in my area.
Wow.
And from then on, we had trouble with the mail. But not one congressman, I'll never forget giving it to a neighbor and my neighbor coming and seeing me. And she said, I cannot fathom that our congressman would permit this to all happen and do nothing. Now, that's what's been going on for 30 years.
Right.
Oh, and in fact, who was it? Richard Armitage wrote a letter to somebody in Congress. You know, Cynthia McKinney had objected to this and asked questions.
Right.
And Armitage wrote a letter saying, it would be wrong to penalize a contractor for the behavior of an errant few. She's just like, what?
That's crazy.
You know, and it was proven by the litigation this was an institutionalized thing.
Oh, yeah.
Anyway, so you know, we've been on the zero accountability standard for many, many decades.
Mm-hmm. It's fascinating. It is. I wanted to mention something to you in talking about things that are coming out now. You mentioned this about Malcolm X. Something came up recently, which was suggesting that the Malcolm X case may now become solved. Something came up recently where Robert Kennedy Jr. said, actually, it was Thane Eugene Caesar who assassinated my dad, not Sirhan Sirhan. And, you know, the right. Kennedys went on the record, which is extraordinary because in over 55 years.
Very dangerous, but.
Yes, absolutely.
Right.
So it's a very courageous statement to have out there, no question about it.
Once America has worked through the Jim Comey, McCabe, you know, all of the FISA court stuff, you know, once you've worked through all of that, you know, then what happened with the FBI on Malcolm X or Martin Luther King, it suddenly makes much more sense.
Absolutely.
Right.
Absolutely. And then the case of Dag Hammarskjöld, who was the UN.
Right.
And, you know, as the director of the UN, it's fascinating because they took him down in a plane crash because of the.
No, I haven't watched. Have you watched that new documentary about his assassination?
Yes. Yes.
I'm dying to watch it.
Yeah, it's quite good, actually. But what's interesting is that the UN has now turned around and said we need to reopen that case, which has been hanging out for a while. So they have these cases coming forward. That's kind of a wave there. Of course, they still avoid giving out the records of the JFK assassination.
Well, but here's the thing. If you look at the speed at which that wave is progressing.
Yes.
And the institution of new controls that they're layering on while it's happening.
Right.
I would say that we're getting further and further behind.
Yeah.
So if you look at what they're doing on vaccine mandates, if you look at what they're doing on nanotechnology, possibly in those vaccines, if you look at what they're doing on 5G and the JEDI contract, and you know, I think to a certain extent, you know, these are good things that are happening.
Yeah.
But you have to translate that into what are the new controls being layered on.
Right.
I mean, here's the reality. FASB 56 and the institution of secret books by the U.S. government and a variety of other players, you know, you're talking about a system that's moving rapidly in another direction, and you have a variety of players out there, including Daniel Estulin, trying to promote tyranny.
Which is amazing.
And make it fashionable.
Yeah.
He, as Daniel said, he works for Russian intelligence.
Right. Well, right. This is something quite fascinating, because this is somebody who's put out all these books about Bilderberg and has been on the side, at least in public, of promoting transparency, and then turns around and promotes Trump as basically being the dictator of America for life.
Here's the thing. I think if you don't understand how we got here, you don't understand how to get to democracy. It's clear the establishment wants to tear up democracy. But I'm not interested in helping them. Democracy is possible, and democracy can really work.
Mm-hmm.
Now, democracy can't work unless you can face the facts of what's really going on, which is difficult because we don't know. We know some things, but we don't know everything about why, you know, trillions of dollars have been disappearing for 20 years and the establishment thinks that's a plan. You know, where's the money been going, and what are they using it for, and why are they doing it? I know, but our entire society has organized around producing trillions of dollars of dividend that goes someplace.
Right. It is. It's like lie upon lie in that sense. Right. You know, there's that great scene in My Dinner with Andre, since you're talking about movies today, and where, you know, Andre's talking and he says, you know, it's like the 1960s were the last gasp of humanity before it was sort of brought down. And that's what they were thinking about in the early 80s. I think that's kind of fascinating.
You know, it's funny. When I was in Hamilton, I was running Hamilton, and a group of the IT guys, who were very alpha male, they were wonderful guys, came in, and they were trying to persuade me to back down on something. They were scared, and they were trying to get me to back down on something. And we had a real knockdown, drag-out conversation. And what came out was they had all, one of them had been a freedom rider, you know, during the civil rights. But what came out is they had all done these amazing things in the 60s. And then what came out was that they had lived through the assassinations. And those assassinations had made them give up.
Uh-huh.
And deep, deep down, they had enormous, deep, deep-seated fears of being assassinated. You know, and it wasn't necessarily them being assassinated. It was me being assassinated. But you were afraid of this other.
Uh-huh.
You know, it was that we're all afraid of that guy from the CIA who's going to come kill us.
Right.
And they didn't even realize that this was a deep-seated fear, and that they had been sort of puppy-trained in giving up on humanity because of this fear. And I realized, you know, one of the things that happened was, as those assassinations occurred, you know, I hadn't given up. I just, you know, got into, you know, financial stealth.
Right.
But I realized so many people gave up.
Yeah. Yeah. Well, it's incredible, because the program, as it were, taking out those leaders was incredibly effective.
It was.
Yeah, remarkable.
It was. I remember that there was that scene in Bobby Kennedy for President, when somebody says, she says she's not going to vote for him because if he wins, he could be killed.
Yes.
Yeah.
Yeah. That was something. In December, right around Christmas, speaking of both houses of Congress, they both passed the Space Force.
Right.
And the first amount of money toward that has come out now. And to get the Space Force, Trump had to call space a warfighting domain, which the United States wasn't signed on to previously. And it was definitely not when it started. They actually prevented language from like that from being used.
Right, and I think it's still a violation of our treaty agreements.
Yes.
Yeah.
Absolutely.
We did a Solari report on space law. And okay. If you go to Solari in the library, you can find it. And it
Fantastic.
Describes sort of the state of the law. And they've never been able to do subsequent treaties because nobody can ever agree. Because the United States will never agree. And I think the reason the United States can is they're using it as a, you know, they've been using it for weapons for quite a while. You cannot dominate on the Silk Road unless you have a dominant position in space.
Right.
In space weaponry. Now, can they get that with the Chinese and the Russians as capable as they are in coming on? I mean, I think, you know, if you look at 5G, AI, space, all these issues, we run the risk that the world divides into two domains. You know, so think of this as a digital infrastructure, and the financial system that plays on that digital infrastructure. One is controlled by China and one is controlled by the US. And those are what one writer called the AI superpowers.
Uh-huh.
Because their ability at AI and technology is racing so far ahead of everybody else's. And if the coronavirus is biowarfare, then there's a chance it's to make sure there's only one digital domain, not two.
Right. Yeah. Oh, well, that's a thought.
Right.
Incredible. Catherine, the dangers of militarizing space, how does that come into play here?
Here's the bad news, Daniel. The danger is not that we militarize space. The danger is that we're militarizing everything.
Yes.
So in the series we did this year called Deep State Tactics, one of the things I said to people is, the first thing you need to understand about cybersecurity is there's no such thing. These systems were created to basically control and compromise security from the get-go. So there's only cyber insecurity. There is no cybersecurity.
Right.
So if you look at where this is all going, you are watching war built into, you're building the whole global economy around digital infrastructure, and then you're using that digital infrastructure as a war domain.
Uh-huh.
You're using space as a war domain. You're using the financial system as a war domain. You're using lending as a war domain. You're using drugs as a war domain. In other words, what is it on this planet that isn't being weaponized?
Yeah.
So this is not just space, this is everything.
Yeah, it's a great question. It's a fantastic question. It's an excellent point. The advent of the Space Force and the advent of the work you've done in the Missing Trillions Department and the advent of the media toying around with groups like TTSA about, oh, you know, UFOs are real after all, I guess, and the CIA running a lot of that. How does, and you're very brave about this.
So,
so I appreciate that you'll come out and talk about this, but yes.
Well, so you know we have a debt problem.
Yes.
Okay, now, what is the value of a sovereign bond? So all the debt problem comes with massive amounts of sovereign bond.
Mm-hmm.
A sovereign bond is a bond issued by a sovereign government. Now, for, you know, since 1640 approximately, we've had a model that says the sovereign government has jurisdiction over physical force within its area. right? And therefore it can tax and extract value to pay the bonds. So the credit of all that debt depends on the sovereignty of the nations involved. With FASB 56 and things like it, you're moving the control of the military capacity outside the sovereign government.
Right.
And you're admitting that there are all these spaceships flying around that we can't stop or control.
Mm-hmm.
So what you're basically saying is sovereign nations don't have sovereignty. We look at Mexico and we see the Mexican cartels telling the government that they have to give back the people they arrested because they have asserted physical control over these communities. And the government capitulates because they don't have sovereignty. Okay? So part of the problem of what TTSA is doing, I thought at first they were doing what they're doing so that the Department of Defense could say, trust us, the 21 trillion went to good use. We're protecting you from the aliens. So everything's okay. You know, and it's back to mommy, the aliens made me do it. But, you know, there's a fundamental question of sovereignty here, whether it's FASB 56 or the spaceships.
Yeah.
And that is our entire financial system is predicated on the integrity of sovereignty, and the integrity of sovereignty is going away.
Right.
Right. Now, I talk about it because if you look at the financial system, on any question that comes back to a family and what they need to do to, you know, to save, to prosper, to thrive in this environment, it all comes down to, you know, where's the currency system going? Where's the equity markets going? All of these different things. And to try and grapple with why things are happening the way they're happening, you have to understand who's governing it and why are they behaving the way they're behaving.
Uh-huh.
And to do that, you have to take into account all known phenomena of who it might be. You know, and my, you know, one of my questions is our economy closed or open?
Yeah.
Because in a closed economy, our debt problem is one problem. In an open economy, it's a different problem.
Right. And based on all your research, how do you see it, closed or open?
So to me, it's behaving much more like an open economy. But that doesn't mean it is.
But it raises a pretty big issue.
Yeah, it's a very big issue. You know, and that's, I remember when I did the Planet Debt wrap up, you know, I told you, I tried to figure out who owns the debt. I know all these people issued the debt, but who owns it? Can't find the, I've tried for years to get the information on who owns it.
Wow.
You know, and that's when I started to say, well, are they on planet or off planet? Who owns it? So the reality is, the world makes much more logical sense if we are having communications and interactions on a multiplanetary basis. Now, it's clear, I believe the reason we globalized was to create the productive capacity to become a multiplanetary civilization. I mean, that's all on the record. That's all clear.
Uh-huh.
And the reason I did all the different studies that we did in publications on space early on was because I was sure it was going to go here. It had to, whether it was you're going to preserve the reserve currency or you're going to become a multiplanetary civilization. And I think one of the reasons they're pushing for a much more globalized currency structure is if you're going to build civilizations on Mars, then you are going to trade multiplanetary and you need to have a central bank that can engineer, you know, the trade back and forth.
Uh-huh.
You know, it's one thing to have a currency that holds value on one planet. It's another to have currency arrangements between multiple planets. That's, you know, that requires a different kind of financial infrastructure. And there are people who argue that that's why gold has had its inherited value for so long.
Interesting. Yeah. Yeah, absolutely. Just to go a little further down that road, so the media, via really the Central Intelligence Agency, has talking points. And whenever they talk about UFOs now, they'll show that TTSA sort of bad footage thing.
Right.
And they always refer to the people involved, and they'll always cite them. No matter what story they're talking about with UFOs, that's always there. Where are they moving in terms of talking about the UFO subject and being open about it? Because it's not a real transparency, but where are they moving with it?
I have no idea. I mean, from what I can see, it's kind of, you know, it doesn't look like a move to real disclosure to me. I think it, you know, it looks a little bit like entertainment or steam valve. Mm-hmm. So they often run steam valves, which is, you know, pressure is building, and that pressure could really interrupt the third rail. And so they like to take it off into an entertainment space or a steam valve space where people, you know, who are getting in a state of agite about the secrecy, say, see, you know, they're really dealing with this and they're working on it. And, you know, I guess I don't have to worry about the 21 training because it was well spent. And, you know, look at all they're managing, and it's, you know, so it's a little bit whiteout, it's a little bit distraction, it's a little bit entertainment.
Yeah.
And again, if you look at how slowly, how much time they engage there, but how fast they're moving on control.
Yeah. Forget it. We'd fall more and more behind, even with the revelations right. that we get.
You know, while we're going around in the TTSA circle, they're, you know, it's keeping us at a relatively low learning speed while yeah. they're skyrocketing.
We mentioned a term, UFO economy, in 2014 in talking about this. And as the years go by, our conversation about that makes more and more sense.
Right.
Interestingly enough, as does your report from 2015, Space Here We Go.
Right.
That thing is so ahead of its time. I actually can see that they were bothered. If they were reading your stuff, they were probably bothered by the investment themes there around space.
When I started to talk about a secret space program, or where this money was going, or the underground bases, or the fact that the Navy tried to persuade me that aliens exist and live among us, any of these things, when I started to talk about that, I was basically, with a few exceptions, completely expelled from the independent financial media.
Mm-hmm.
That was it. I was, you know, I put a big scarlet A on my back. You're out. Now, my attitude was, we've got to get to the truth. I don't know what the truth is. But you can't take half of an economy and pretend it doesn't exist.
Mm-hmm.
I can't pretend $21 trillion, you know, went missing or didn't go missing. I can't pretend the 24 to 20 trillion didn't roll out on the bailouts. And this is not money for Wall Street partners to have Ferraris. You know, this is money to start a civilization on Mars.
Mm-hmm.
That's the kind of money this is. So when you look, you know, it's so strange to listen to most independent financial professionals talk about the currency, because unless you're looking at this half of the economy, you can't begin to understand the currency. And the climate change job has nothing to do with climate change. It has to do with putting into place the electrical smart grid that can handle breakthrough energy and currencies on scale, particularly cryptocurrencies, because it's very energy, you know, expensive.
Yeah.
So, you know, I don't know, Daniel. It's, I don't know how they managed to persuade the financial world that if they talked about this, you know, they would lose their masculinity, is the only way I can think of it. Or they would, do you know what I mean?
Yeah, absolutely.
But I'll never forget, there was a great speech that Bobby Kennedy made after he left the California legislature over the mandate fight. And one of the legislatures had said to him, you know, if you keep doing this, you won't have any friends. And in the speech, he says, you know something? I have a lot of friends. But the financial world had a way of persuading you that if you delved into this, you would absolutely, you know, have to live alone on an island. You would be completely excommunicated. Mm-hmm. I don't know how that happened or why it worked, but it was clear that if you were going to understand the fundamental issues of sovereign credit and how currencies work, that you had to integrate this. Uh-huh. And it was also clear that the United States was going to maintain the reserve currency, that they would have to dominate the space. And so this was a very, very critical issue on the rise of the land empire.
Remarkable. It's interesting to me too, because it almost seems that now it's FASB 56, which I should say is spelled out FASAB 56.
Right.
Where you're kind of standing alone and bringing it out.
Well, it's really funny because I'm writing the state of our currency now. And as I'm writing it, I'm saying, oh boy, this is going to be my new alone. You know, because I go out, I'm alone. And then everybody says, ah, yes, you know, and then I go out and I'm alone. Yes. You know, so, what's important to me is to figure out really what I believe.
Right.
That's the hard part. But then, you know, I come out with it and, and the wrap ups really serve that purpose. And it's valuable because I get a lot of feedback, positive and negative, but it's all informative.
Right.
Yeah, so Sam Smith has a great line. He says, all the news while there's still time to do something about it. So I want you to know about space while you still have time to do something about it.
Right.
You know, so I want you to have your sunglasses.
We need those They Live sunglasses now.
That's what we all need, right? That's what we're all trying. That's what you're trying to do. That's what I'm trying. We're all trying to, you know, build a pair of sunglasses.
Mm-hmm. Absolutely.
Don't you think?
No question about it. Catherine, thanks so much.
Always a pleasure, Daniel.
Thank you for joining me for this special episode with former Assistant HUD Secretary Catherine Austin Fitz on Space Wars, AI Superpowers, and the Black Budget. You can find more special reports, deep interviews, and documentaries by going to www.darkjournalist.com. You can also subscribe here to our YouTube channel to receive the latest videos. See you soon.